This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
2022 is starting with a bang. Major unrest unfolding in a couple of countries that we'll lead off the program with today. First, Kazakhstan. A major anti-government, pro-democracy uprising there is putting pressure on Kazakh leaders, and they're about to get some serious outside help. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yeah, the situation in Kazakhstan has really exploded pretty much overnight. It started on Sunday in one really remote part of the far west of Kazakhstan. It happened because the government had ended some subsidies on the price of liquefied petroleum gas. So the prices just shot up, and a few dozen people took to the streets to protest. But by Wednesday, the anger of those first few people had spread into every major city in Kazakhstan, and it had just transformed from a very narrowly focused economic protest into an overtly political and just a broad-ranging demonstration. The people have been showing that they're sick of the corruption and all of the stifling problems that come from it, and they're out there in these sub-zero temperatures day after day, showing that they have had enough of this entrenched regime that has ruled Kazakhstan since it broke from the Soviet Union in 1991. So that regime was headed by Nursultan Nazarbayev. He was actually in power even before the Soviet Union collapsed. And Kazakhstan under him was said to be the only Soviet nation that was more Soviet even than Russia. You know, there was even a brief time after Russia had ended the Soviet Union and all the other countries left, but Nazarbayev decided to keep it going in Kazakhstan for as long as he could. So the Soviet Union for a short time was Kazakhstan, essentially. That's how much this man just loved that system, that evil system. So he's now 81 years old, and he had formally stepped down as president back in 2019, but he really remained the de facto head of the country. He remained head of the ruling party. And so that was part of what these protesters have been furious about. Not just because Nazarbayev has been there forever, but because he's deeply corrupt. He's siphoned off so much of the country's wealth for more than three decades now. And even after stepping down, everyone knew that he remained really the true leader of the nation. So this week, those protesters started tearing down statues of him across the country. In Almaty, the nation's largest city, rioters set fire to a presidential residence and also a mayor's office. Actually, all across the country, they've set fire to administrative buildings. They've also captured the nation's main airport. They've killed at least 13 members of the national security forces, including two who were reportedly decapitated. So just incredibly violent riots. Another 350 security force members have been injured. So, you know, government officials have tried to compromise where they could. They reversed the decision to end those fuel subsidies. The whole government was also sacked on Wednesday, and Nazarbayev was stripped of the remaining titles that he had. The government also shut down the internet a couple of days ago, just in an effort to prevent the protesters from being able to organize. But the protesters were not subdued by any of this. So the government ordered security forces to just crack down on them, and there are reports that more than 2,000 have been arrested, several dozen have been killed. Probably those numbers are much higher, but because of the internet blackout, the information is pretty limited about what we're getting. But in either case, none of this was really taking the power out of the protest movement. So that's when President Tokayev, he's the man who took over, at least superficially, back in 2019 as Nazarbayev's handpicked successor. But late on Wednesday, as the country was just, you know, descending into flames all across, he called on Russia. He actually asked Russia to send troops in to help the government establish some control. And as you can imagine, Vladimir Putin was very happy to make this happen. It was actually less than 24 hours after Putin got that call that Russian paratroopers began touching down in Kazakhstan. And since then, an undisclosed number of quote-unquote peacekeeping forces have been arriving. We know that there are at least 2,500 troops there under the banner of the Russia-led Collective Security Treaty Organization, the CSTO. But reports suggest that there could be far more than that from Russia. But, you know, once again, with the internet blackout, it's been tough to get hard numbers with some of that sort of thing. But we know that this is a country that shares thousands of miles of border with Russia. It's a former Soviet nation, of course, so Putin will do anything he can to prevent some sort of big democratic revolution from happening there. And now he's got boots on the ground to prevent it. And this gives him, I think, all kinds of opportunities to actually tighten his grip on Kazakhstan, even, you know, even after those protests end.
Putin, of course, very experienced and skilled at putting down pro-democracy demonstrators in his own country. Well, you referenced the larger plans that Putin has for Kazakhstan. Maybe you could just talk about that in his grand plan that he's been enacting for some time now.
Yeah, sure. I think it is just tremendously important to watch Vladimir Putin, his maneuvers with Kazakhstan, because this is a country that was part of the Soviet Union. You know, we've spoken several times about his grand plan for the Soviet Union. We got a very salient bit of information from him early in his reign when he said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the 20th century's greatest geopolitical catastrophe. You know, that was just a terribly important statement because it provided a roadmap for a major part of his foreign policy. And in the years since he said that, we've seen him do basically everything he can to reverse that so-called catastrophe. So he's trying to rebuild the Soviet Union. Putin is a dictator at heart, and he looks back very fondly on the prestige and the power that Russia had when all of that Soviet territory was under Russian control. And so that's what he's been trying to rebuild. That was the motivation behind Putin's invasion of the former Soviet nation of Georgia 14 years ago, and also with Ukraine about 8 years ago. In both of those cases, he took territory that had been under Moscow's control during Soviet days, and he brought it back to Kremlin control. And then we've also seen Putin assert more and more control over Armenia, Azerbaijan, Belarus, and Uzbekistan, Tajikistan as well. In all of those former Soviet nations, Putin is asserting more and more power over them, and now he's doing the same thing with Central Asia's largest economy, Kazakhstan. And it's all driven by that same goal of reestablishing Russian power over its periphery and just bringing more of the old Soviet territory back under Putin's power. But geopolitical strategist Peter Zion wrote this week that all the evidence indicates that now that Putin has these troops in Kazakhstan, he's unlikely to ever pull them out. So, you know, Kazakhstan looks like it's set now to become a satellite state to Russia, probably akin to Belarus. One statement from Zion says, "Kazakhstan's days of being functionally independent or even nominally independent are now pretty much over."
Boy, that is quite a rapid development. This all basically occurred within the span of a week, and it just speaks to that long-term strategy that Putin has so effectively implemented in so many of these former Soviet satellites.
Yes. Yeah. And this is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has been sounding the alarm about for a number of years now. He's been talking about Putin's dictatorial ambitions because of what the Bible says about a multinational Asian alliance that will be built in the years ahead. Mr. Fleury has often pointed to Ezekiel 38 to show that this alliance will be led by one Russian individual. Verse 2 calls this man the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And Mr. Fleury has said that that individual has to be Putin. Those names denote Russia and then two of its major cities, Moscow in the west and then Tobolsk, more toward the east of the country. And In Mr. Fleury's booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, he writes, "The use of all three names, Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, shows that this is an individual ruler of all the peoples of Russia, from west to the east. The reference to the cities of Moscow and Tobolsk helps us see how vast Russian territory is in these latter days." And then here's a very interesting sentence when you consider what's happening right now in Kazakhstan. Mr. Fleury writes, "This giant swath of land indicates that the Prince of Russia will probably conquer more nations of the former Soviet Union." Mm-hmm. End quote. So, you know, this, I think, shows us just how important it is for us to watch Putin closely as he keeps on asserting more control over over Russia and its periphery, and especially the former Soviet nations like Kazakhstan.
The Prophesied Prince of Russia is the name of that booklet. We'll link to that in the show notes. Jeremiah has also written an article about this development in Kazakhstan. With Kazakhstan in flames, Russia's moving in. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Quite a story there. And now to Africa and the nation of Sudan, where the public has been protesting military rule since a coup in October. A big development there this week plunges the nation into more uncertainty. For this, we'll turn to Mihailo Zekic.
Yeah, on Sunday, January 2nd, Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok resigned. He was the civilian leader, whether officially or in actual power. It's hard to estimate sometimes with a country like Sudan, but he's been in power since 2019. When longtime Sudanese strongman Omar al-Bashir was ousted in a coup. Now, Omar al-Bashir was a really, really nasty individual. He was on the U.S. List of state sponsors of terror. He's been in power. He was in power for about three decades. And when he was ousted, there was a lot of hope that Sudan would go into a new civilian democratic rule. And Hamdok, who was a former UN economist, was selected to hold an interim government until elections could take place. But the military still cast a heavy shadow over everything that went on in Khartoum. And in October, they had a falling out with Hamdok and put him under house arrest. And since then, Sudan has been having basically nonstop protests. Over 50 people since October, protesters have been killed from the security forces trying to get the military out of their government. And in November, about a month later, they reached a deal with Hamdok to put him back under shared rule. A lot of the protesters just saw this as a fig leaf of sorts to legitimize the coup. And even though Hamdok was back in power, this United Nations technocrat, they weren't really happy and they wanted even more change. And so Hamdok gave them what they wanted on Sunday. He basically said he was trying. He's trying his hardest, and he failed. He basically admitted that in his resignation speech. And so at this point, it's not really known who his successor will be. The military, of course, under their main general, their General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, still, of course, exerts a lot of control. And it's speculated, well, I shouldn't even say speculated, it's almost certain that whoever is named prime minister after Hamdok will almost certainly be under al-Burhan's thumb. And because of this, the protesters, and it's not just the coup itself, there's like this massive inflation in Sudan, there's food shortages, people are basically just upset with everything on there. And now that Hamdok is gone and his successor, not only is it unknown, but exactly how he's going to come to power is not certain at this point either. It's just going to exasperate the situation so much more.
So can you just give us a sense of politically where Sudan is? Here you have this, as you were talking about the rule of Omar Bashir, that it went for quite some time. What characterized his rule? What the military leaders are trying to do to hold the country together, and how this is failing, but what's at stake, and what might emerge? Who might take advantage of this instability that's taking place here, and where might this lead Sudan into the future?
Well, as mentioned, Omar Bashir was not a nice guy. He sponsored terrorism. He was responsible for the infamous Darfur conflict that was in the news a few years back. He was actually really, really good friends with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and which is another reason why the West hated him. And once he was out, a lot of Western countries were cautiously optimistic. Through the negotiations of United States President Donald Trump, Sudan even recognized Israel, one of the few Arab states to do so. It looked like that it was about to turn to a more democratic, Western-oriented direction, which, especially for a country in the Arab world, isn't would have been a remarkable achievement. And since the coup, the West has had mixed feelings about what's happening in Sudan. Now, the military's pledged to continue the country down a democratic transition. They scheduled elections for 2023. That's for a long ways away from now. And the United States withheld about, or suspended about $700 million in aid to Khartoum because of the coup. And now that there's it's almost certain that whoever replaces Hamdok will become or will be under the military's thumb, they're threatening other financial repercussions, not just the U.S., but the United Kingdom as well, the European Union, if this ends up happening, which would – the small chance that Sudan was about to turn to the West looks like that's going to be now nipped in the bud if this all happens. And the military, of course, it's Omar Bashir's leftover military, basically. Mm-hmm. And they may turn to Iran for support, or we could see complete chaos and state collapse in Sudan. And if that's the case, then no one really knows what's going to happen. In his resignation speech, Hamdok said that Sudan was at a, quote, dangerous crossroads threatening its very survival, unquote. And we just saw not too long ago the southern part of Sudan, South Sudan, split off. And that's still a country that's reeling from civil war. If the rest of Sudan ends up getting caught into something like that, we get a muddy, muddy quagmire. But again, Iran is the traditional sponsor of Sudan. Sudan, of course, is an Arab state. It's famously about 200 years ago had a radical Islamist insurgency under the Mahdi that Winston Churchill famously battled against. So it wouldn't be too surprising if radicalism ended up taking control of Sudan. And if that's the case, Iran would be the country which has tentacles in places like they sponsor, for example, al-Shabaab in Somalia. They were friends with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. That wouldn't be too surprising if they ended up taking advantage of the situation and getting control of Sudan, or at least some sort of influence.
Based on your understanding of biblical prophecy, does that seem like the likely outcome of this? It's always hard to predict, especially in the middle of this kind of chaos, but are we expecting Sudan to turn to a pro-Iranian orientation?
Well, Sudan isn't specifically mentioned in modern Middle Eastern prophecies per se, but as listeners, longtime listeners of the program will know, we often go to Daniel 11 verses 40 to 43 to discuss about what's happening with radical Islam in Africa and in the Middle East. And there it talks about a king of the south at the end time that it has a very pushy foreign policy that controls a lot of proxy states. And since the 1990s, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, constantly points to Iran being the king, this king of the Middle East, this king of radical Islam. And from verses 40 to 43, it talks about some of Iran's allies or proxies, you could say. It talks about Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia, all these countries that are in the African area. So we expect Iran to go and extend its tentacles into Africa a lot more. And the Sudan, it's an interesting one because it's technically not mentioned, but at the same time, it is right between Egypt and Ethiopia. So, I mean, again, it's anyone's guess on what can happen. But if Egypt manages to if Iran manages to get control of Ethiopia and Egypt, it would be logical that they'd also get the country that's in the middle of it as well. At the same time, of course, things could turn a little bit differently, as I'll discuss in the second half of the program. We could potentially see Sudan turn to Europe. The people of Sudan, they're really excited about democratic rule. That's what they're protesting for, and if somehow they manage to bring Sudan to complete civilian rule, if somehow the military loses its grip Europe with its generous financial assistance to a lot of countries in Africa, especially ones that are trying to wave the banner of democracy, so to speak. It would be a logical partner to step in. They've propped up a lot of other countries, like in Mali, for example, to fight Islamist insurgencies there. And as I'll discuss in the second program, we could potentially see Europe go in there. But either way, Sudan, it's a big country. It has a big population. It's in a very sensitive part of the world, very prophetically important part of the world. So whatever happens, it would be important to see what happens with Khartoum once it's all said and done.
Well, if you want to know more about the prophetic implications of what is happening here, you are welcome to read our booklet, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy. We'll link to that in the show notes. Thank you very much for that, Mihailo. Now to Germany. The nation's new chancellor, Olaf Scholz, is preparing to move his nation into a closer relationship with China. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I think this. We've been talking quite a bit in recent weeks about the role of German businesses in setting German foreign policy. We had a kind of a blockbuster Key of David from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry really talking about the way that German businesses have been pushing Germany into a very different foreign policy world, one that is much closer to Russia, and that is going to be the subject of some big articles in the upcoming Trumpet print edition. And I think it's really interesting that with this story, you can see something very similar happening with China, where you've had a government that has come into power in Germany that has very different rhetoric to China, where the foreign minister is from the Green Party, and the Green Party has talked repeatedly about standing up for China, about having an ethical foreign policy, a foreign policy where business deals don't help the bad guys. And the reality has been very different. The reality has been where you had the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping being very first person to call the new German Chancellor, where you've had lots of very, very positive comments from the new German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, where the President Xi has been talking about the great importance of his country's bilateral relationship. Scholz just held a virtual summit with the Chinese leader just a few weeks ago, and he talked about the coming up with a new European Union China investment deal as soon as possible. This is a deal that a lot of the rest of the European Union doesn't really want, that Germany is pushing. Now, why is all of this happening? Well, this is happening because by this point, Germany and China have such close business deals that it doesn't really matter what Scholz wants or what Annalena Baerbock, the foreign minister, wants, because they can't disentangle from China without causing massive headaches to the German economy. Imports from China have doubled, exports have tripled over the last 12 years. Massive increase between these two. China is Germany's biggest trading partner for the fifth year in a row. And so as soon as anybody like Annalena Baerbock starts talking about, well, maybe we need to do a bit more on China, you have things like the chairman or the CEO of Siemens coming out and saying, no, you know, we can't decouple from China. We need it. And he even points out, even as a Green Party, you need it, because where else are we going to get our solar panels from? It's just a very interesting example of business leaders, by creating this business relationship with China, have made an effect of an alliance and alignment for Germany that is very difficult for politicians to unpick, even if they want to.
Well, it is another instance of how China has created these relationships really the world over, using economic tools that end up having pretty dramatic political ramifications, and you have to credit China for kind of taking every tool that it has in its arsenal to promote its policies in nations all over the world. Here, Germany, the most powerful and important nation within Europe, having to tread very lightly in doing anything that would threaten those economic ties. this is significant prophetically when we look at what the Bible says about the relationship between this European powerhouse and this Asian powerhouse. Maybe you can just frame that in those prophetic terms for us.
Yeah, certainly. So one of those big things that Mr. Flurry has been focusing on in that Key of David that I mentioned is, you know, the Bible has prophesied about this beast power in Europe, as it refers to it, this dictatorial power that rises and then goes into the bottomless pit, as Revelation 17 says, or to put it in better language, it goes underground. And so he was talking about the way that within a lot of these German businesses, you know, we have documented proof that German industrialists at the end of World War II said, well, you know, we're going on, that they're going underground, that these groups would continue to kind of push for the revival of this German empire, but they would do so from behind the scenes and they would go underground in the business world. And Mr. Flurry focused on this relationship with Russia. And we've got a big thing talking about how these German companies have built this economic relationship with Russia that is then very hard, and you know, even forcing Angela Merkel to go along with things like Nord Stream 2. In a lot of ways, they're the ones in the driving seat. They can't, it's a democratic German government cannot really back out of this. And we see the same thing with China, where these German businesses have built this really strong relationship with China. You know, it's VW, it's Daimler, it's, you know, it's the luxury German car makers that have to account for massive chunks of German export and this kind of thing. So they've created as well this really strong relationship with China. And this relationship is something that's prophesied as well. The Bible talks about in Isaiah chapter 23, this mart of nations, where merchants from around the world, from lots of different countries, all kind of get together, build a strong trading relationship together. And then you put that side by side from other Bible prophecies, and it talks about the United States being, and Britain and other countries being shut out of this trading market. And that's what's happened here. That's where you see this relationship between Germany and China. I think what's fascinating is it's been this massive uptick in the last 12 years. And it was about 12 years ago that Mr. Flurry first started talking about this mart of nations prophecy in Isaiah chapter 23. That forecast this strong commercial relationship between Germany and China. And it has been built pretty much within those last 12 years. Nobody was talking about it back then. It's just a really an exciting example of fulfilled Bible prophecy. So that's really what's behind it. You're seeing this alliance being built. It's being built as an economic alliance first, just as the way the Bible talks about it being having the strong economic component. But that economic component will then later be turned against the United States. And we have quite a few articles that talk a lot about this this Mart of Nations. We've got a reprint article called The Great Mart of Nations that explains this prophecy. And then also I just mentioned Mr. Flurry's Key of David article or Key of David program from a few weeks ago that we will be writing up as well, or that will be written up. He'll be writing that up for the Trumpet Print soon, Germany Going Underground.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Richard. We'll certainly link to those in the show notes for today's program. Yesterday marked 1 year since the January 6th protest in Washington, D.C. over the 2020 election. Democrats have used this incessantly to try to paint Trump supporters as terrorists and enemies of democracy. It's quite a rich accusation they're making. For this story, we will turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it is quite amusing to watch in a way, because it just really seems like it's the only thing the Democrats have in their toolbox to try to prove that Joe Biden is the legitimate president. There's actually huge millions of Americans who think the election was rigged. Rather than get up and either ignore those claims or try to debunk those claims using statistical evidence or drawing attention to some of the recounts that have happened. The Democrats, they just do seem to double down on the fact that, like, well, the election can't have been rigged because there was a protest on January 6th last year. And you're like, it's like, well, whether the protest was right or not is an interesting debate, but it's kind of a non sequitur to whether the election was rigged or not, because it's like, even if there was like some violence on that day, it's like, if the election was rigged, it was rigged. It was the people's response to that is a completely separate issue. But Joe Biden gave some remarks on Thursday in commemoration of the first anniversary of the January 6th protest, saying those who stormed the Capitol, those who instigated and incited, and those who called on them to do so held a dagger to the throat of America at American democracy. And then really doubled down on the fact that, like, Donald Trump just isn't just a former president. He's a defeated president. Again, no statistical evidence to debunk the claim that the election wasn't rigged, but just coming in and focusing on this attack as the only tool in his toolbox. But it didn't take President Trump but just a few minutes to respond to these claims made against him, issuing several press statements, written press statements, saying that Biden, who is destroying our nation with insane policies of open borders, corrupt elections, disastrous energy policies, unconstitutional mandates, and devastating school closures, used my name today to further divide Americans. This political theater is all just a distraction for the fact that Biden has completely and totally failed. Our country no longer has borders, has totally and completely lost control of COVID, is no longer energy independent, inflation is rampant, our military is in chaos, and our exit or surrender from Afghanistan was perhaps the most embarrassing day in the long and distinguished history of the United States. And so, like I said, he definitely he didn't talk much about the election rigging in his comments, but he definitely did a really good job pointing it to it, like how bad things have gotten since he was gone. And think that'll begin to resonate with more and more Americans. Actually, it is resonating with more and more Americans from what this next point will show is Mark Elias. He's the Hillary Clinton campaign manager who was involved so deeply in the production of the Steele dossier to come up with the Russia collusion hoax against President Trump. Well, now he's saying that there's many Republican senators and Republican congresspeople who are getting ready to run in the midterm elections, and it looks like there's a good chance a lot of them are going to win because people are getting fed up with all those failed policies that President Trump just mentioned. Mark Elias is actually suggesting that like 120 of those candidates be barred from running because of some tenuous connections they have to those January 6th protests. And so I've even seen some liberal commentators come out and say that basically what Elias is suggesting here is to use January 6th to pre-screen candidates, kind of in a similar way to like candidates are pre-screened in Iran. Mm-hmm. Iran is allegedly a democracy. The people do get to vote, but no one can run for office until Ayatollah Khamenei has approved them, so that no one ever gets elected who the mullahs don't like, because no one's ever allowed to run who the mullahs don't like. Mm-hmm. And basically what Elias is suggesting is a similar thing. It's like, well, we're going to try to use basically, and when he says connected to the January 6th protest, he basically means is like, well, any Republican candidate for office who claims that the election is stolen is guilty of inciting violence on January 6th, ergo they need to be barred from office, so that the only people who can ever run in the future are those who say that the 2020 election was perfectly free and fair.
Hmm. Yeah, the exposure of the Democrats' radicalism continues to become more stark. You see the way that they've been hammering away at everything associated with January 6th, 2021, that it's just become more and more rabid. And Stephen Fleury has been bringing out on the Trumpet Daily program just how even among Republicans you have it's exposing how many of them. He was talking about Ted Cruz, who a year ago he was saying, well, we need to hear these concerns about the 2020 election. The quote-unquote insurrection happens, and he and all of these other senators completely stop that and change their tune and say, you know, we've got to move forward. We've got to put all of this aside. And it was just a few days ago that Ted Cruz says that those who tried to protest in D.C. a year ago were actually terrorists. And this is a big threat to our democracy. You can see, I think Donald Trump makes the point that most Americans see right through all of this. It doesn't matter how many times they say that this is what happened. There's a huge segment of America that just absolutely is not buying it. And you'd have to, you'd think that there is going to be a pretty significant blowback or backlash against all of this at some point, based on what we know about prophecy.
Right. Well, definitely the fact that Mark Elias is talking about banning candidates for office shows that he's not confident that the American people are buying his narrative that the election was free and fair. Otherwise, candidates who were running on a platform of the election was stolen wouldn't get very far in the democratic process. And so the fact that he's even saying they need to be banned for office shows just how fearful the Democrats are that if these people are allowed to run, they're actually going to come to power. Mm-hmm. But then also, like I said, we can put Mr. Gerald Floyd's article on what will happen when Trump returns to power in the show notes that goes through the prophetic proofs that that one way or another President Trump will return to power. You're definitely starting to see more and more evidence of more and more people who are seeing through this. Like I said, maybe some of the leaders like Ted Cruz who stood up for it initially have kind of broken under the pressure. But amongst the common people, I think there's it seems like the poll numbers you see still shows an increasing number of people who believe that the election was stolen, and now there's also that increasing amount of evidence that even a lot of those protesters were either FBI infiltrators or influenced by FBI infiltrators to stir up violence exactly for the purpose of anticipating that once there was violence, people like Ted Cruz would back down and not protest the election like they had planned to.
Well, we will link to Gerald Flory's article, What Will Happen After Trump Regains Power. And if you want more information about how the Democrats are using this as a weapon, you can listen to the Trumpet Daily, really excellent programming that Stephen Flory has been producing for that program. And I highly recommend that you keep up with what he has been talking about there. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, more China news, a stunning new deal that reveals its plot to virtually take over Latin America. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We spoke in the first half about China's relations with Germany and how we're seeing its policies enabling it to really take over the world. A new deal shows that's exactly what it's trying to do in Latin America. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, China is really intensifying its focus on Latin America. They've been on just a spree of inking new deals with Latin American and Caribbean countries. These deals are for everything from building 5G networks to building a great number of schools that will teach classes about Chinese language and culture. There's also plans for nuclear power plants and even space programs for Latin American countries. So it's just a really far-reaching initiative that China is undertaking in the Western Hemisphere. This is called the Joint Action Plan for Cooperation in Key Areas, and it involves just about every country in the region, including major players such as Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, and Venezuela. And I think it's important to know that this new action plan is not at all out of the blue. This is a continuation of decades really of Chinese investment and development in Latin America. A lot of that has been under the banner of the Belt and Road Initiative, but a good bit of it actually predates that. In those initiatives, China has pumped hundreds of billions of dollars into the region to build ports and roads and power plants. And so this new set of deals, this new action plan, is just the logical continuation of that. Now it's going beyond ports and roads into joint space programs. And it's going beyond hydroelectric power plants to nuclear power plants. So it's all just very clearly about China trying to buy influence in Latin America, so that China is really the hegemon there. And more analysts are coming to see that. Mario Haidar of the Heritage Foundation wrote about it this week. He said, quote, "There are absolutely ambitions for China to become the dominant influence in Latin America. There's absolutely a security and military interest there, and that threat is growing." End quote. So it is an alarming bit of influence that China already has bought in Latin America. And in light of this new action plan, it's set for, I think, an exponential increase.
So to think about China actually moving into Latin America, the biggest concern has to be the geostrategic position of this Asian giant just moving in right in America's backyard.
Yeah, that's really why this is such an important story from the U.S.'s vantage point. China's new action plan will translate into considerably deeper influence that China will have in the whole region, and that includes those parts of the Caribbean that the U.S. relies on a great deal for shipping and receiving. We know from this action plan that Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela are of particular interest to the Chinese. That's where a lot of their efforts are focused. And the port of New Orleans and the port of Houston depend on open lanes that that are around those countries in the Caribbean. So for China to be moving into these countries and buying influence is just very worrying. It could really shut off some of the most vulnerable and important shipping lanes that the U.S. depends on.
Talk about the prophetic implications of this, Jeremiah.
Yeah, well, Richard hit on this a bit in the first half, but there are prophecies in Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 that talk about a mart of nations, or an economic alliance that will form between China and Russia and various European nations. And when you put those alongside Deuteronomy 28:52, it's clear that this economic alliance will come together to besiege the U.S. and some of its allies, and to block them out of world trade. That passage in Deuteronomy 28 says that America will be besieged in its gates. And we have an article called Storming America's Castle that puts these different passages together, and it shows just how serious the threat that America is facing is. The article really focuses especially on nations in and near the Caribbean that China and Russia are deepening their influence in. And this article shows how this assault on America will happen in large part from there. One part of it says, "The Caribbean Sea is vital to U.S. security. This sea not only connects the East Coast with the Pacific via the Panama Canal, it also guards the mouth of the Gulf of Mexico. Half of America's seaborne trade passes through the Gulf, so a foreign power that controls the Caribbean could cripple the U.S. economy by restricting its access to oceanic shipping." End quote. So, you know, when we see China pumping billions and billions of dollars into Latin America, building all kinds of power and influence for itself there, I think we should see that it is creating the conditions for that prophesied siege to take place.
Well, we will definitely have to keep our eyes on that story as it develops. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Israel looks like it could be working to sell missiles to the North African and Arab nation of Morocco. For this, we'll go back to Mihailo Zekic.
So according to a January 6th article from the Jerusalem Post, Morocco is reportedly negotiating with Israel Aerospace Industries, which is an Israeli defense contractor, to buy the Barak 8 surface-to-air missile systems. And reportedly, Morocco also wants to purchase Israeli drones. These are unconfirmed at this point. Both the Israeli and Moroccan governments are a bit tight-lipped about this. But if this manages to be confirmed, this would be a big deal. Barak 8, it's actually a joint venture between Israel and India, and it can hit aerial targets up to 70 kilometers or 43 miles away. It can hit multiple targets simultaneously. It's equipped to deal with bad weather, so it's pretty heavy-duty new technology. And this falls on the heels of, in November, Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz went to Rabat, Morocco's capital, and signed a defense cooperation agreement with the Moroccan government. This is huge. This is the first time Israel has publicly made a defense agreement with any Arab state ever. They've had informal relations with certain more moderate Arabs for a while, but this is the first of the public ones. And it wasn't that long ago, just a few decades back, when most of the Arab world actively wanted to destroy Israel. And now we see Israel potentially arming an Arab state with weapons. Now, Morocco is one of the more moderate Arab states. They jumped into the so-called Abraham Accords of 2020 that was negotiated under U.S. President Donald Trump to normalize relations with Israel and certain Arab states, including Morocco. Mossad, the Israeli Foreign Intelligence Service, has cooperated with Moroccan intelligence for decades. Morocco has allowed, prior to this, Israelis to visit the country with Israeli passports. So it is, perhaps among Arab states, a natural partner. But while Morocco, the Moroccan government, is friendly to Israel, the people aren't as friendly. A 2020 survey from the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies suggested that 88% of Moroccans rejected recognizing Israel. And there were even figures within the Moroccan parliament that disapproved what the king of Morocco has a bit more power than some other figurehead monarchs do. They disapproved of what the king was doing with the negotiating with Israel. So while the Moroccan king and his defense ministry might be okay with increased relations with Israel, as are some other parts of Moroccan society, there are plenty of figures in Morocco, especially among the people themselves, that are, like many, many others in the Arab world, still aggressively hostile to Israel.
It's important to look at the relations between Israel and these Arab states in light of the prophecies of the Bible. Our editor-in-chief actually did a pretty major article about this in the January 2021 Trumpet edition, Deadly Flaw in Mideast Peace Deals. Can you just summarize the prophetic view of what's happening here?
Of course. Now, technically, that article, the earlier version of it was written before the Morocco deal, but the principles still apply. The deal looks at the Abraham Accords through the lens of Bible prophecy, and specifically Psalm 83. It talks about an alliance between various Middle Eastern peoples, and in verse 8, it talks about Asher, or modern Germany, being involved with them. Verse 4 talks about them trying to blot out the name of Israel so it's no more in remembrance. And we've identified the various peoples that are in the psalm as the Arab states, the Turks, Syria, Lebanon, the more moderate countries. Some of them still have to join the moderate camp. But it talks about specifically them joining with Europe. And Morocco, it's interesting, it's a former French colony. It's actually the biggest importer of French weapons in Africa. And France has a lot of military investment in a lot of different African countries, Algeria, Chad, Mali. But Morocco's the biggest. And France is one of the biggest weapons exporters in the world. So they're very, very much close together with the forming European Union. And combine that with the anti-Israel sentiment that so many of the Moroccan people have, and you see perhaps a perfect storm building for an enemy that Israel might actually think of as a friend because of its friendly relationships with its king, even though that Morocco would end up becoming in a perfect position to backstab Israel along with Europe and the rest of the so-called moderate Arabs.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for that. We'll link to that article from Gerald Fleury, Deadly Flaw in Mideast Peace Deals. Thank you, Mihailo. Leaders' efforts to bully the unvaxxed are getting increasingly tough. A remarkable example this week from the president of France. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, it was. It exposed a lot of even just the emotion and anger behind what some of these leaders are doing. To give a maybe sanitized translation, the French president Emmanuel Macron said on January 4th, "I really want to annoy the unvaccinated," and he used a pretty vulgar word there instead of annoy. But you know, he's saying he wants to go out of his way to make life difficult for those that have not gotten the jab. And the French Parliament is in the middle of passing a new law that would stop people being able to take a COVID test and instead of having the jab. So right now in France, you have to show your COVID pass to go to a restaurant, to do anything that's kind of deemed luxury. to take long distance travel, but you can get a pass if you've had a negative COVID test in the past 24 hours. They want to get rid of that. So you can only get that pass if you've had the vaccine. No getting around that. Just today in Italy, they passed a similar law now where for over 50s, they're making the vaccine mandatory. So for all of Italy, it used to be if you went to work, you had to have one of these COVID passes. And if you didn't want to get the vaccine, you could pay every 48 hours to take a test at your own expense. If you're only over 50, that is no longer an option. You have to get the jab or you have to lose your job. And it's yet to be seen. Italy may be following in Austria's lead, where they may even have fines and potentially prison sentences for those over 50 that refuse the jab. Of course, in Austria, that applies to everybody. They haven't announced that yet. So it really is continued dramatic push in this direction within Europe to have this forcing people to take this private medical decision. Now, we have an article in our January 2022 Trumpet print edition that I wrote, Lurch Towards Tyranny, that talks about the biblical prophecy here. And really, that's built around an article that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote right at the very start of the pandemic, where he said the people of Europe are being conditioned to accept more and more tyrannical leadership. That's exactly what we're seeing this week. You know, the ratchet just gets tightened further and further every few weeks as they get conditioned to more and more tyranny. And then the same process is underway in a different way in Britain and America, too. And we have an article in that same January edition about that. But Mr. Flurry made those predictions because of Revelation chapter 17, because of these prophecies that forecast a very dictatorial Europe. And you can read that article to get more that puts that in its biblical perspective.
We will link to that. We also have an article on this declaration by Macron specifically. Macron declares war on the unvaccinated to the bitter end. And it is a very prophetically significant trend to watch this unfold in these European nations. Thank you very much for that, Richard. What's stunning is these leaders are saying these things in spite of evidence of the dangers posed by these experimental vaccines. For evidence of this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, an Indiana insurance executive dropped a bombshell statistic during an end-of-the-year news conference where he's actually reporting that amongst working-age people, those aged 18 to 64, his insurance company has noted a 40% increase in the death rate this year. So amongst like working-age people, people who aren't dying from old age, a 40% increase in the death rate. And he said that most of the death claims listed are actually not listed as due to COVID. That's normally to expect during everything you hear about a pandemic that COVID's causing this increase in death. They said it's for non-COVID related cost, which is really mysterious. You're like, well, what would cause 40% of the people, of working age people, to start dying in 2021 when they weren't before? It says that it would have to be, there has to be some big change that happened this year other than COVID itself that could be causing this. And while a number of doctors, including a vaccine scientist, Dr. Robert Malone, and the statistician, Jesse Rose, agree that the COVID vaccines, the mandatory COVID vaccines, should really be the prime suspect right now of like what has like over 4 billion people on earth done in the past year or so that they haven't done before that could be causing this huge rise in the death rate. And so there are still some investigations that's going to have to be done from this. But like as Dr. Robert Malone said, he's like, if this is true, then COVID-19 vaccines, this is the biggest failed medical experiment in human history. Mm-hmm. You took a new experimental molecule that hadn't been tested and basically decided to use 4 billion human beings as your guinea pigs. And now the results could well be coming back that you'll have this huge spike in the death rate, not in spite of the vaccine, but because of the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And he even in other comments called it, he said it just like the cognitive dissonance or the illogical rationalization that like you're looking at this could be causing a 40% increase in the death rate. And yet people like Macron and others are still looking for every ways to get the 4 billion people on Earth who haven't taken the vaccine to take it as well. He called it a mass formation psychosis, which our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, had his trumpet brief this week on mass formation psychosis, quoting pretty extensively from Dr. Robert Malone, even mentioning briefly this 40% increase report from the Indiana Insurance Company, and just showing that there's really a pretty sinister spiritual dimension behind this that allows human beings to be to be so irrational that you're looking at hard evidence that this vaccine could be causing millions of deaths around the world potentially, and yet your biggest concern is like, well, how do we get the half the world's population who hasn't taken it yet to do what the other half the world's already done?
I feel like this is my theme of the comments that I've made this this program. Listen to the Trumpet Daily. Mr. Stephen Fleury's really hit this point hard about the the rise in what we call will worship in the world today. There's no stronger evidence, no better example than what we're seeing here, exactly what you have articulated. People just, despite all evidence to the contrary, insisting that people continue to inject themselves with this experimental vaccine. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. We will link to that America is Suffering Mass Formation Psychosis article in the show notes for today's program. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Mihailo Zekic, and Richard Palmer. And thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Alexander the Great. I'm not afraid of an army of lions led by a sheep. I'm afraid of an army of sheep led by a lion. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.